Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello, good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable, your weekly dose of apologetics debate, faith discussion and conversation starters, really, wherever you find yourself on the faith spectrum, because this is the program where we aim to get all kinds of points of view, deliberating, talking and having conversations that matter. Welcome along to the program and all part of Faith Explored every Saturday, where we bring you a range of shows here on Premier Christian Radio to help you think through your faith. And later on, you can hear the profile. Between 4 and 5, I'll be sitting down with astrophysicist Luke Barnes, who is the author of A Fortunate Universe, Life in a Finely Tuned Cosmos. He was actually a guest on Unbelievable a few weeks ago with atheist cosmologist Sean Carroll. And so we're going to be hearing some of your feedback to their conversation at the end of today's show as well. But it's my extended interview with Luke himself that you'll be hearing between 4 and 5 on the profile today. That's available, of course, as a podcast in its own right. If you look online for it on iTunes or at the website, premierchristianradio.com/theprofile. But this show, Unbelievable, where we get these conversations every week, is also available to listen back to anytime. And we've got a growing podcast audience around the world. I think we're clocking up for about 3 million downloads of the show this year, believe it or not, on Unbelievable. So it's great to be constantly hearing about and hearing from new listeners to the show. Welcome along if you've recently started listening to Unbelievable via podcast. And you can do that yourself. Tell friends about it. Get the latest info, shows, resources, DVDs, books and so on from the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And just before I tell you about what's coming up on today's show, which is a really interesting debate on science and spiritual practices, just a quick word about loads of great shows still to come before the end of the year. Next week, Mormonism. We're going to be talking to two ex-Mormons and a Mormon about the faith. Fazer versus Ahmed. Yes, Ed Fazer, who I've long wanted to have on the show, a Catholic philosopher with a new book out called 5 Proofs for God, is going to be in debate with Cambridge atheist philosopher Arif Ahmed. You can look out for that on your iPod or on your radio set soon. Was Jesus a failed apocalyptic prophet? We'll be debating that. We've got street epistemology, a discussion on that coming up. Lots of exciting stuff for anyone who's interested in the whole area of faith debate on the show. So look forward to hearing what you have to say about all those shows and more going forward. If you want to leave your comments about today's show, or indeed to find out other ways to get in touch with the program, all available, of course, at the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. All the ways to download the podcast and indeed ways to find out more about Unbelievable, the book, which continues to attract interest and attention and various types of reviews as well. Be interested what you think about it. This coming week, actually, just as a podcast extra for anyone who listens to Unbelievable via podcast, you'll be able to hear the first chapter of the book in its audiobook form. I'm going to put that out. And if you want to get hold of the audiobook or indeed the book and signed copies available, of course, from our own website, then do go to the website of the book, unbelievablebook.co.uk. Why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. That's the theme of the book. Tells the story of the show and makes my case for faith. unbelievablebook.co.uk. Okay, time to get into today's discussion.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today we're debating science and spiritual practices. That's the title of Rupert Sheldrake's new book. Now, Rupert is sometimes regarded as a bit of a maverick in the scientific world. In fact, his TED talk on the science delusion was purportedly banned following an outcry from atheist scientists. You can now see it on YouTube. The talk was based, though, on Rupert's book, The Science Delusion, which claimed that modern science has become allied with a number of materialist, atheist assumptions about the nature of reality that should in fact be questioned. Well, Rupert is a Christian, and his new book, Science and Spiritual Practices, explains what atheists have lost by abandoning religious and spiritual practices, and how people of all faiths or none can actually benefit from the scientifically proven positive effect of spiritual practices. Well, discussing this with Rupert today is Susan Blackmore. Susan, atheist, well known in the field of psychology. She appeared recently, actually, on Unbelievable, debating her new book, Seeing Myself, The New Science of Out-of-Body Experiences. Now, unlike some of her atheist colleagues, she's a champion of spiritual practices, but does disagree with Rupert's worldview that science needs to change to accommodate spiritual realities and the mystery of consciousness and such things. So we'll be hearing from Sue in a moment. She's on the line, but joining me in studio today is Rupert. Rupert, welcome along to the programme.
Glad to be here.
It's very good to have you. Rupert, you've been someone who's come up once or twice over the years in discussions here on this programme, because, as I say, viewed by some as a bit of a maverick as regards your approach to science. But take us a little bit further back, because what I really enjoyed reading actually at the beginning of your book is the preface, where you talk about your own spiritual journey. At one time you were an atheist yourself.
Yes.
You sort of had a spell during university then, when that was the case. What led you down that path at the time?
Well, it started at school. Just part of the worldview of science as taught by science teachers was atheism. It seemed to be a package. You know, the basic message I was getting was that science represents the future, progress, scientists are in the vanguard, religion drags people back into dogma, conflict, etc. I just thought, fine, I want to be part of the future and so on. And I have to say that one of the things that was a big selling point for atheism in the early 60s was sexual liberation.
Right.
Religion meant no sex before marriage, whereas atheism meant sexual freedom. That's a very big selling point. When I was at school and at university, and then I'm reading atheist authors, you know, people like Freud and Marx and so on, it seemed to me a consistent worldview, and it worked fine for about 10 years.
So you sort of rejected the Christian sort of tradition you'd been brought up in. What brought you back to it eventually?
Well, first, I think psychedelics, which...
Not the most usual path, necessarily, for many people. But.
I think today it's probably a path for a lot of people. I mean, a mind expanding, an experience of the mind being much, much more than anyone had told me, much more than I'd learned in physiology lectures at Cambridge. Suddenly, there was this huge expansion of the nature of the mind. And that was followed for me by an interest in going into other realms without drugs. And so I took up transcendental meditation, which at that time in the early 70s was marketed as a completely physiological process. Mm-hmm. You didn't need any belief system. It just did you good. More or less what lots of people say today, but they were ahead of the curve. And then I worked in India. I spent 7 years in India. And I got into Indian philosophy, the Vedas, the Upanishads, and I was very taken with Indian culture. But after several years living in India and going to ashrams and dialogues by guru, talks by gurus and so on, I just felt drawn back to a Christian path. I went through a Sufi phase too, so
oh, wow.
It was quite a long journey.
Very diverse in that sense, yes.
Anyway, I was drawn back to a Christian path, and I was then confirmed in my 30s in the Church of South India. And then really felt a conflict between the Christian and the Hindu path. Some of the Indian Christians I knew thought that all Hinduism was devil worship and you should not have anything to do with it. And I knew that it had deep philosophies and many holy people in it with great insights. And then I met an English Benedictine monk who lived in an ashram in South India, Father Bede Griffiths, who for me was the perfect bridge between these two traditions.
And very much opened up the Christian mystical tradition to you as well.
Absolutely. I didn't know anything about that before. Mm. All I knew about was the rather more evangelical kind of Christianity or the very high church kind that I'd had at school.
And when you did eventually return to the UK, you continued in the Christian tradition, but obviously with this sort of element that linked you into the meditative practices, the spiritual practices that obviously have continued to undergird your life.
Exactly. And one of the things I also did when I got back here was that rediscovered the Christian tradition. Because in India, one of the things that really impressed me was the way that Indians go on pilgrimages to shrines and holy mountains and temples and so on. India's crisscrossed with people walking on pilgrimages. And then when I got back to England, I realized how many sacred places we have here, our great cathedrals, many holy places, and the fact that that pilgrimage was very much part of the Christian tradition. It was suppressed at the Reformation, but it's been coming back in recent decades, and indeed that's one of the practices I discuss in my book.
And we're going to talk about those practices in the course of the programme. Obviously, alongside this spiritual journey you'd be having was your scientific career, and that involved biology and particularly the study of plants and so on. And but again, you were no stranger to controversy on this front, because and we won't go too deep into it today, I think, but you came up with a theory called morphic resonance, which is to do with something that appears to be beyond just the biological sort of fundamental sort of physical forces that are involved in producing plants and life and so on. You believe that there was something extra going on. I mean, do you want to give a very, very thumbnail description of that?
Yes, it's basically the idea that there's a kind of memory in the universe. The so-called laws of nature are not fixed at the moment of the Big Bang. In fact, nature's not governed really by laws, in my view. Laws imply a very anthropocentric metaphor, a lawgiver and a law enforcement agency, a role that God played in 17th century science,
right,
but which most scientists no longer accept. And I don't either. I think that they're more like habits, the regularities of nature. There's a kind of memory built into nature. Each species has a kind of collective memory. A lot of biological inheritance, I think, happens by morphic resonance, which is the resonance on the basis of similarity across time. And even our individual memory, I think, depends on resonance with ourselves in the past. I don't think it's stored in the brain.
And which all goes against the predominant sort of materialist philosophy of nature and consciousness and that kind of thing. And sort of what got you your talk into a bit of trouble after it appeared on the TED Talk website and got, you know, people rather angry about it, actually, in the scientific community.
Yes, I think they got angry about it partly because of morphic resonance, but partly because I was saying that science has become increasingly dogmatic. It's become a dogmatic belief system. And the fact that militant atheists like Jerry Coyne and P.Z. Myers, who got my TED Talk banned by TED. I mean, it's still on the internet. You can't ban anything any longer. You can try. They tried. But they get extremely angry. Now, a lot of atheists are extremely dogmatic and deny anything that goes against their worldview and try and suppress alternative points of view as they did. Now, there are a lot of perfectly reasonable atheists, and you know, many of my friends are atheists, so it's not as if I'm against all atheists.
You're not tarring them all with the same brush.
No, I'm against dogmatic atheism, which I think holds back science by creating it as a kind of dogmatic belief system where the mind is nothing but the brain. It has to be that because that's what the ideology says.
We'll get into this, of course, in today's discussion. And joining us very kindly, somewhat short notice, is Sue Blackmore, who's very hastily read the book over the weekend, but is already familiar with your work, Rupert. So, Sue, welcome back to the programme today.
Thank you.
It's great to have you on. In some ways, your journey sort of overlaps with Rupert's to some extent. It was also sort of late 60s, early 70s that you were starting to dabble in the field of hallucinogenic materials and mind expanding consciousness and that sort of thing. Of course,
I don't think it was quite dabbling. I think it was more I always put those in experiments. No, I mean I took these things. I suppose the first time might be called dabbling, but then I discovered, as Rupert was saying, that everything changes with, for example, LSD or mescaline. And I've recently just got back from two weeks in Brazil having several sessions of ayahuasca, which is really, really a deep challenge and changes everything in another way again. So, yes, that's played a big part in my life. So, in a way, Rupert and I have a great deal in common, and all of his spiritual practices that he describes in the book, I think, are absolutely... We need people to realize that this is what I think is really great about the book. People of all faiths and none can and will and do benefit from these practices. Where I have such disagreements with him, as you might guess, is precisely what you were talking about towards the end of what you were just saying, which is, why bring in morphic resonance? Why bring in consciousness being something, you know, something else, something other? And why be so dogmatic about claiming the scientists are dogmatic? I've been involved in the field of consciousness studies since it really began back in 1994 with Dave Chalmers' coining of the phrase, the hard problem. And there I see people, yeah, there are some dogmatic ones, but mostly it's people struggling with, given we know this about the brain, given we know this about the body, given we know this about the way machines work, given we know this about evolution, how can we cope with consciousness? Where does it fit in? What's it doing? And there are so many different theories. That's good science. That's not dogmatism.
Interesting stuff. I mean, let's start with the things you agree with then in the book, Sue. And before we get into that, I should just say, if you're listening and you'd like to give your thoughts on today's programme, you can, of course, email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And don't forget that you can find today's show online, share it on, and indeed comment underneath it as well, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And you can find it on the Twitter and the Facebook as well, and leave your thoughts there. @unbelievablejb for the Twitter handle, facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the show's Facebook page. Be delighted to hear from you in all those ways.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
We're talking about science and spiritual practices today. Rupert Sheldrake, sometimes regarded as something of a maverick in the scientific world, but his new book, Science and Spiritual Practices, explains what he thinks atheists have lost by abandoning religious and spiritual practices, and how people of all faiths or none can actually benefit from the scientifically proven positive effects of spiritual practices. Maybe before we get into talking about the science, let's talk about the spiritual practices first. And there's seven areas that you specifically outline in the book, Rupert. These are gratitude, meditation, connecting with the more than human world, plants, rituals, singing, chanting and music, and pilgrimage. And what's interesting is you begin by talking about, and indeed end the book by talking about, the fact that because we live in an increasingly secular westernized society, people have maybe unwittingly abandoned many practices that their forebears would have done, and with them the benefits that are associated. Do you want to talk about some of these scientific benefits that have been shown to accrue with some of these particular practices down the ages?
Yes. Well, the meditation is probably the one that's been studied most, and meditation is now practiced by many millions of people through mindfulness and other meditation techniques. And many of the people who practice it are not Christian or belonging to any religion. I mean, it can be treated as a purely secular practice. And there are secular Buddhists who do it, who don't subscribe to Buddhism as a religion. So what the research shows is that lots of people who meditate have great physiological benefits. Lower blood pressure, calms them down, sleep better, less anxiety attacks, they're less depressed. And that's why you can get prescriptions for it now in some parts of Britain on the NHS for mild or moderate depression. So the benefits of meditation are now well established, and people have looked at changes in the brain when people are meditating, and different areas become active, which is what you'd expect. So there, the benefits are very clear. Gratitude, the positive psychologists have looked at this, and they've found that people who are grateful are happier. And then they ask the question, well, are they happier because they're grateful, or are they grateful because they're happier? Because the skeptics said, well, you know, of course they're more grateful, they're happier, they have happier lives. It turns out that if people do simple gratefulness exercises, like making a list of counting their blessings, for example, or writing a letter to someone who's helped them that they've never properly acknowledged, saying thank you, they become happier, measurably happier.
Now, as a Christian...
Can I jump in?
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead, Sue.
Because I absolutely agree with you, and I think it's taken me a long time in my life to come round to deliberately... I don't do it as a specific practice that you advocate in the book, which I think is a good idea, making it a regular specific practice. I don't do that. But I've learned gradually over more than 30 years of daily meditation and all kinds of other things that have gone on. I do very often, wake up in the morning, go out. I live by a little river coming off Dartmoor down in South Devon. And, you know, this morning was typical. It was our first frost. And I'm going, oh, this is so beautiful. Oh, worrying about the plants and the frost as well. But as an attitude of mind, yes, it can be transformative. What I would object to, though, is you said, Rupert, something like, you know, hardline atheists like, you know, Daniel Richard Dawkins, or the materialist people who believe that, you know, that matter is all there is, it makes no sense to be grateful. Or I think you say, if you consider, as I do, that the universe has no ultimate purpose. There's no ultimate function. There's no God who made it. It's not going anywhere in particular. It's just evolving through natural selection and all the other processes. It's essentially mindless, essentially purposeless. That's what I think. And yet gratitude bubbles up within me. I don't see that that being an atheist really in any way deprives you of the capacity to be grateful for being alive, for the green leaves I can see over there and the birds I can see flying across the bridge over the river.
I once read a quote, and I'm sure I'm not quoting it correctly, but it was from someone, some wit, who said, the problem, it turns out, with atheism is that I've no one to be grateful to or thankful to. Who do you direct the gratefulness you have in your heart?
I think that you've exactly hit the point there. Everything in general, because that's when I bow before my daily meditation every morning. I'm not bowing to the Buddha or God or anything else. I'm simply bowing to whatever is around. In fact, probably to the present moment. Because in a way, you know, a lifetime of meditation and thinking about these things brings many people back to, well, actually, all we have. We don't really own stuff in the way that sometimes we get deluded into thinking. All we have really is this now. That alone, that's the essence of mindfulness. That alone raises loads of questions and I think can give rise to gratitude. And all it is gratitude to this, whatever it is. And even the mystery. I feel quite grateful that, you know, here I am able to contemplate the great mysteries of why we're here, what's the point of it all, and so on.
Well, let me swing it back to you then, Rupert. What does there need to be an object of our gratitude, if you like, as there obviously is in a Christian tradition? I mean, when I go to church, the first thing we do are prayers of thanksgiving.
Yes.
It's about giving thanks to the one we believe is responsible for all the blessings we have in life. But Sue says don't need that necessarily as an atheist.
Well, what Sue says is about the sense of presence and the mystery of why things are. And actually, for me, that's what I feel too. I don't really disagree. Because the practice of meditation, and indeed almost every spiritual practice, except perhaps pilgrimage, where you've got a goal ahead of you, is about becoming more present and more connected. And insofar as... Well, God, in any definition of God, is conscious, and the consciousness of God is in the present. I am.
See, that doesn't mean anything to me. I can hear the words, but what does that mean?
I think for me, the really big question, you see, and is if there's a consciousness out there, a consciousness pervading all the universe throughout nature, there's a far greater consciousness than ours. Most atheists I know think that consciousness is confined to brains, that, as you said yourself, the universe is basically unconscious. The spiritual practice that really is the litmus test here is not meditation but prayer. And recent surveys of scientists in Britain, France, and Germany have shown that many atheists meditate. Well, about 10% of scientists who are atheists meditate, but 0% pray, because prayer presupposes that there must be a form of consciousness beyond your own to which you can pray. And prayer involves this kind of relationship with a greater consciousness, which can also involve gratitude to a greater consciousness than our own. And it seems to me that what you're calling presence and mystery is another way of talking about that, but without actually naming it. But I think that by naming it, or at least by recognizing the existence of a greater consciousness than our own, it opens up possibilities not just for gratitude, but for prayer.
Well, here's another way of going at that. I think all of these scientists and atheists that you're talking about almost all of them, reject Cartesian dualism and indeed most forms of dualism. In other words, they would say, you know, it really doesn't make sense. The more we study the world and everything else, it doesn't make sense to think of minds and bodies and brains as separate things, as Descartes thought. You know, this kind of thoughts and they're kind of, you know, not in space and time, our thoughts, our mental phenomena, qualia and all that stuff. And then there's the actual physical world. That doesn't work. So what are we going to do? How are we going to incorporate consciousness into our physical world? Well, there are lots of ways that people explore this. Panpsychism is becoming increasingly popular. Not the sort of trivial idea that every atom is conscious or something like that, but more something like it's all pervading. Or how about a sort of view that a monist view, I mean, you know, probably from prayer, but certainly from psychedelics, that you can get into a monist understanding of the world when you kind of know absolutely that we are not separate. My mind is not separate from the world out there. There isn't a me in here and a world out there that I'm observing. This becomes clear in many deep states of meditation with some psychedelic drugs. Now, when we come back to thinking logically and with our awake scientific brains, we can't see how monism can be so. Nevertheless, there are plenty of people playing with these, including me, this underlying idea that consciousness and matter somehow have to be the same thing. They can't be separate. How do we understand that? And then, of course, you said somewhere in the book, I think, that many of these scientists that you are so heavily criticizing think that consciousness is confined to human brains. Well, in two ways, that's a very uncommon view, because of the whole move over the last 20 years away from the brain towards embodied consciousness, embodied cognition. Brains are nothing if they're not embodied in a body that interacts with the world. And the other is questions about animal consciousness and machine consciousness, because the more we look at how the amazing machinery of the chemical and physical machinery of brains and bodies works, the more we see commonalities with every other species and also with the machines that are fast coming along. I think in that way, we, if I can say we as the people you're criticising, are actually far more open to all these difficult and interesting ways of thinking what consciousness is, and well aware that it's not just my little thing inside my head.
A quick response, and then we'll go to our first break and come back to this question, Rupert.
Well, first of all, Sue, I don't think I'm caricaturing some of these atheists. After all, I'm attacked by them all the time, so it's not—they're not straw men. They're all too real. Now, I don't include you as a straw man. First of all, you're not straw. Secondly, you're a woman. But and I think I actually agree with a lot of what you say. You see, panpsychism—I'm very keen on
Can someone just define panpsychism for me? It's not a term I'm terribly familiar with.
The idea there's a kind of mind or consciousness or literally soul, psyche, in all things.
Okay.
So it actually means that things like subatomic particles, atoms, molecules, crystals, cells, plants, animals, even solar systems and galaxies have a kind of mental aspect as well as a bodily aspect.
Is this what David Chalmers sort of subscribes to-ish? Or
sort of. Yeah. Yes, and quite, as Sue says, a growing number
of people. I've even heard atheists like Philip Pullman say quite similar things, even on very programme, where he said, I get into trouble with my friends like Richard Dawkins for saying things like this, but he believes there's some sort of a consciousness somehow embedded in the fabric of the universe, as it were.
Yeah, and so do I. You see, Sue's point that, you know, there are these more nuanced views of expanded consciousness, I totally agree. I mean, I'm part of that movement too.
But how do you wed that? My question is, Sue, how does a thoroughgoing naturalist materialist like yourself wed that with, you know, that idea with the fact that ultimately all you presumably really believe there is physical stuff, you know, interacting according to the blind forces of nature?
Oh, no. I'm not a materialist. No, I'm a monist. I don't see any way we can make dualism work, separation of mental things and physical things.
I agree with a lot of that, you see.
When I look around the world, I think somehow it all has to be one kind of stuff. What is that stuff? I mean, late at night when I'm sitting by the fire contemplating, you know, before I go to bed, I often end up with the question, well, what is all this stuff?
Well, don't we all?
What does that mean?
Let's take a quick break here, because we're running out of time in the first section of today's programme. I mean, really interesting stuff, though, here on Unbelievable today. Debating science and spiritual practices. A lot of overlap, but also some differences between my two guests on the programme. Rupert Sheldrake, author of the new book, Science and Spiritual Practices. Discussing today with Susan Blackmore, well known as an atheist in the field of psychology. Her latest book is called Seeing Myself, The New Science of Out-of-Body Experiences. And we'll be back in just a moment's time.
Hello and welcome to the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together with me, Justin Brierley.
For over 10 years, as host of Unbelievable, I've listened to objections to faith from the world's leading sceptics. And the most common question I get is, how come you still believe? Unbelievable, the book, is my answer. Telling the story of the show and drawing on hundreds of conversations with atheists and Christians, I explain why I still believe Jesus is the answer to life's deepest questions. Get your copy of Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, at unbelievablebook.co.uk.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to this week's edition of Unbelievable, debating science and spiritual practices today. Rupert Sheldrake, a guest I've long wanted to have on Unbelievable, and the publication of his new book, Science and Spiritual Practices, gave us a good reason to bring him into studio. He's with me today talking about these issues with Susan Blackmore, an atheist well known in the field of psychology. Both have had sort of mind-expanding experiences in the past, which they say gave them a new outlook on life and spiritual dimension to life, but come to very different conclusions as to what's happening at a fundamental scientific level. Sue believes that in the end, we can explain consciousness, for instance, by the material stuff of the brain and what's happening there. Whereas Rupert is one among a number of people who believes that consciousness is not simply contained within the human subject, it can be expanded. In fact, there's a consciousness throughout the universe. He calls that consciousness God as a Christian. And in his new book, he talks about how people, whether they have faith or not, can benefit from the spiritual practices that so many of our forebears have been through. I think you wanted to carry on before we get into some more of these spiritual practices you outline in the book about the whole issue of consciousness and the way Sue obviously sees it compared to yourself, Rupert.
Well, I just want to follow up a bit more from what Sue said about a monist view, as opposed to a dualist view. I'm not a dualist. I don't think that the universe is made of unconscious machinery and there's a kind of God out there that's outside
the
universe.
A ghost in the shell sort of view of reality.
Or a kind of external engineering God who designed the machinery of the universe, set the laws of nature up, and then pressed the start button. Mm. I don't believe in that kind of God at all. I think that there's, like Sue said, there's a kind of inherent mind-like property throughout nature, that even the sun, the solar system, have not just a body but a mind, as it will. So I think the sun's conscious, for example, and the whole galaxy may be conscious, and that our consciousness is within literally greater forms of consciousness. I'm not talking necessarily about forms of consciousness that have no embodiedness at all. And if the entire cosmos has a kind of mind, I wouldn't actually equate that directly with God. That would be a form of pantheism. Mm. I think Sue's view leads to pantheism, when I don't think there's anything wrong with pantheism. I think it's better than atheism. But then the question is, it becomes a much more subtle question of if there's a mind pervading nature and present in all nature and through all nature, and our minds are part of that, then whether the mind pervading nature also transcends nature so that it could also be part of other universes, for example, or whether it's nothing but the universe. Mm. That then becomes a rather subtle theological point. But I think, and I would say my own position is not pantheist, but panentheist. God is in nature and nature's in God. And Sue will, I know what she's going to say, it's quite unnecessary to bring God in at all.
Are you a pantheist, Sue? I thought you were an atheist
time. I'm not sure. I'm not sure, but he's quite right in that prediction. But actually, I think what's very interesting there is clearly we're agreeing a lot. I mean, I am not a committed whatever any of these names. I play with these ideas, which indeed I do very much, because of the real problem of consciousness. And there are, I would agree with Rupert also that there are quite a few scientists out of there who go, oh yeah, we'll just solve it, it's just what brains are doing. You know, it actually is a serious and difficult problem. But I would like to tackle one point where I think we disagree dramatically. I think everything there that Rupert said, I would agree with, but I think he then goes from there to think that this justifies believing in paranormal phenomena, psychic communication, dogs who know when their owners are coming home, morphic resonance, and so on. My feeling is, if we can really escape from illusions of duality, of self being separate from everything else, or those kinds of illusions, then we will find this kind of oneness that we glimpse in certain cases. But we will not find things that are so popular and that people want to be true. We will not find telepathy, clairvoyance, psychokinesis, precognition, precognitive dreams, the power of the mind, all these kinds of things, I think, are not there. So am I right? We really disagree there, Rupert?
Well, we do. We certainly disagree about that. But I don't deduce any of those things from my belief in God. I mean, it's not a part of Christian faith to believe that dogs know when their owners are coming home.
No, I meant consciousness everywhere, or that...
Well, yes, but surely, you see, what I find...
This is beyond.
What I find puzzling about your view is you're saying that consciousness embodied and stretched out, it's not just confined to brains, that it's more than that. And what I don't see is why you should be so vehemently opposed to dogs picking up their owner's intentions at a distance when they are sort of coupled, therefore in a relationship, they have minds that are linked through daily interactions. It doesn't seem to me, given your worldview, that that's inherently implausible. It becomes simply a question of, is the evidence there or not?
And you believe the evidence is there, presumably, Rupert?
Oh, yes.
There's been studies done which you think confirm that idea.
But the thing is, in a sense, this is a red herring, because not... I don't even mention the word telepathy or ESP in this book, and none of the practices I'm talking about depend on dogs knowing whether their owner's coming home or not. I mean, Sue and I disagree about this. She's a card-carrying skeptic, a member of the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, and I'm not.
Because of decades of research. I mean, I did do decades of research. I was a parapsychologist. I was convinced from my early experiences that my mind could leave my body and go off somewhere else, and that psychic phenomena were possible. And then I did a whole lot of research which left me thinking, that's not the way to understand the mind. And I don't. So I'm struggling with the similar starting points from Rupert to try to understand what is this stuff, because the whole idea of matter comes about through physicists finding things with their machines and so on. You know, we're far from understanding what matter could ultimately be in physics, as we are in psychology, far from understanding what consciousness is. So I'm exploring all these possibilities that somehow they're the same thing. But this does not give rise to either those paranormal things or to the idea, which I'd love to hear what Rupert thinks about life after death. You imply somewhere in the book that, you know, we in some sense, our consciousness survives the death of our bodies. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that would require a complete change in our scientific understanding of the nature of bodies and brains and evolution and so on. And I see no reason to believe in it. But I imagine that you, as a Christian, do believe that there's life after death. Is that right?
I do, yes. At least I think there is. I can't say I can prove it. But I think one of the scientific issues, you see, where we differ is where morphic resonance becomes relevant here, is that if memories are stored in the brain, as most materialists assume they must be, because if the mind is nothing but material process, then memories must be in the brain somewhere, somehow, then clearly when we die, our brains decay and all memories must be eliminated. So anyone who believes memories are stored in the brain, as materialists do, must, I suppose, believe that they're wiped out at death, and all forms of survival of bodily death require some kind of memory. Even reincarnation in the Eastern traditions is a kind of carryover of memory, or at least habits, from one life to another. So firstly, where we differ is, because you don't like the idea of morphic resonance, that I don't think memories are in the brain. So I don't think that the decay of the brain at death necessarily wipes out memories. It may wipe out the ability to tune into those memories, but not the memories themselves. So that's a scientific point, where are memories stored? And as you say, people don't understand most aspects of consciousness. Memory storage has been a subject of long investigation without clear results. These are open questions scientifically.
Do you think they aren't so open as Rupert makes out they are?
Absolutely. I mean, back in the early 70s, when I first, you know, had an amazing out-of-body experience and various other experiences, and decided to devote my life to being a parapsychologist and prove that there's more and all that stuff, I had this theory, which my whole PhD thesis was about, and it was a memory theory of ESP. I had the idea, which I thought was original, and it turned out it wasn't original at all, of course. I had this idea, something like the Akashic Records, that memory is stored beyond brains, and that brains kind of are like, you know, the old idea that they're kind of like a television tuning in to memories that are stored out there. And it was a lovely idea in a way, because then telepathy becomes like another form of memory. It's easier. I had a similarity idea, which relates to the morphic resonance idea, that because our own memories are more similar to ourselves now, we can access them more easily. But in principle, telepathy is just remembering other people's memories from this great store out there and so on. Now, what threw me off that, and I rejected it utterly some, oh, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 years later, was A, discovering that this idea, versions of it have been around for a long time, like Henri Bergson in his Matter and Memory and other ideas. But mainly it was the lack of evidence. The more I went into it, the less evidence I found for that. But I look back and I think, well, in those days, it was psychologists were chopping up planarian worms to see if memory was stored in RNA or DNA or something of this kind. And they had no idea. As the decades have gone by, and now in the 21st century, we have a pretty good understanding of how everything we do changes the synaptic strengths in neurons in our brain. Little tiny dendrites on the end of neurons are growing and shrinking and moving slightly where they connect. All of this is a constantly moving, amazing kind of symphony of things going on in the brain, and that's what memory is. I don't see any longer, very different from how I was 40 years ago, I don't see any longer any need to posit memory anywhere else other than...
It still is a remarkable thing, though. Even the materialist view that you're espousing there, Sue, that somehow, yeah, in the physical electrons and chemistry of my brain, all of these memories are there, and I can call them up at will, you know, what I had for breakfast
it's
this
wonderful.
Morning, or whatever.
And then who is the me who's calling them up?
Quite.
And how do those interactions work? Because I think the me is a kind of illusion. It's a, well, illusion in the sense that we feel that the me is this powerful thing inside there somehow directing the show.
So,
when there isn't
let's
anything
cross,
like that
cross
in
back
the brain.
To Rupert, because your big thing, Rupert, has been that you think materialists like Sue have, maybe I'm using the wrong terminology, but anyway, people like Sue are making too many assumptions about the nature of stuff and reality that maybe are unwarranted, in a sense, that this assumption that it has to be a material, you know, all kind of essentially stored in hard data of material stuff.
Yes, you see, I obviously agree with Sue about the neurons are changing, dendrites are changing, the brain changes when you learn things, and when you meditate, even you can get changes in the brain. You know, muscles change when you lift weights. You get bigger biceps.
We create new neural pathways when we learn new,
yes,
new practices and things.
But I don't think that the assumption that all memories, including memories of where I went on holiday this year and that kind of thing, are all encoded in neurons, this is an assumption. It's a materialist assumption, and it's an act of faith. And it's not proven. We don't yet understand consciousness. As Sue says, it's the hard problem. People are trying out all sorts of ideas. It's an open question. And her act of faith is that it's all in the brain, and I see no need to make that act of faith. I think it makes just as much sense to think as Bergson proposed. I mean, when I came up with the idea of memory not being material, I was actually influenced by Bergson. I didn't think of it as an original idea. The philosopher Bergson in Matter and Memory, which Sue quoted, argues for memory not being stored in the brain. This is the materialist act of faith, is that it is in the brain and that we don't yet know how it works, but given another 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, we will know. It's what Sir Karl Popper called promissory materialism, issuing a promissory note against future explanations. It's an act of faith. And there's nothing wrong with acts of faith, but what I don't accept is that one of them is hard science and real, and the other's just a kind of wishy-washy act of faith.
I'm sure you want to come back on this, Sue, but before we get to that, I do want to talk at least about one or two other of the spiritual practices you outline in the book. I mean, do any of them specifically point beyond themselves to the worldview that you do espouse, which is obviously one where there is a God and there is this ultimate consciousness to which we are being grateful, for instance, in the acts of gratitude as one of the spiritual practices. But do you want to talk about any of the others that sort of key into that in any way?
Pilgrimage, for example. Well, that again is ambiguous. Sue would be able to interpret it her way. And I think that going to holy places where people have prayed and where great things have happened in the past, that I think the whole act of going on a journey to a holy place is something that's good for you physically. You're walking, you're in the countryside, you're in the fresh air. All these things are known to have benefits. You're doing something with a purpose that's known to be good for you.
Very often, I don't know what you make of this, Rupert and Sue as well, but I often hear of people when they walk into a very ancient church, for instance, say it's as though the atmosphere is different in there because there's almost the walls have soaked up, you know, hundreds of years of prayer and meditation and so on. I mean, do you literally believe there's something that can be different about a physical space in that sense, spiritually speaking, in that sense, Rupert?
I don't myself think that it's because the stones themselves have soaked it up.
I think that might just be a metaphor.
It's a kind of metaphor. I think that when we enter a holy place where people have prayed for centuries, then we tune in by morphic resonance. This is where my morphic resonance idea would come in. We're in a similar place, the similar sensory stimuli, similar situations, similar smells, visual stimuli, that put us in resonance with people who've been there in the past. And so something of the collective memory of people's experience in that place, including mystical experiences, spiritual experiences, prayer, and so on.
And especially if you're taking part in the same sorts of rituals that they took part in.
Exactly. Morphic resonance plays quite a big part in my understanding of rituals, because if you do things in a similar way as possible to the way they've been done before, which rituals on the whole do, they're conservative, then you create situations where morphic resonance can occur in this connection across time. And I think that's one of the rituals is one of the practices I discuss in the book. So these are things which I think do depend on this memory across generations.
Okay, so this word, morphic resonance, has popped up a few more times here, Sue. What do you think, though, is happening when people claim that they have some sort of a connection with a particular place where perhaps many generations of people have prayed and had spiritual experiences?
Well, I get that feeling every week when I live in a little village in Devon, and we have a beautiful ancient church which is just delightful, and I play in our village samba band. I play loud drumming and every week we rehearse in the local church, and I have to say, having been brought up as a Christian, the first rehearsal I went to and everyone's standing around banging and making this horrendous noise, and it was a sort of feeling, ooh, this is a bit naughty in this wonderful place with this deep feeling. And then I glanced up and by the bell tower there's a beautiful inscription carved in wood, and it said, "Praise him with a loud cymbal."
There you go.
I thought that was a wonderful coincidence.
But what do you think is actually going on when people say they experience these sorts of things? Obviously, you know, Rupert here believes it's something to do with morphic resonance. But yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, I wouldn't for a moment deny people experience that. I would say something is going on is the evolution of memes. I mean, in the sense, the churches and the mosques and the pilgrimage sites that we go to have survived the test of cultural evolution over hundreds of years, because they invoke that feeling. People have found that they have those deep feelings more often when they have lovely smells, when there are resounding bells that go on and on and on, and you don't really know when the sound stops, when you have a certain echoey feeling as you walk along the floor. All of these things, they are preserved over the centuries because they have these effects that bring joy to people, or sometimes they can produce fear. They can produce all kinds of effects in us, and I don't think we need to add some unsubstantiated theory. Now, Rupert will say that there is evidence for morphic resonance. I was involved in one of his very early experiments with morphic resonance, which did not work out. It just gave chance results. you know, I can think of experiments that I would do if I were convinced we needed this kind of theory, or that there was a good chance that, we did. Then I would do experiments like I would take to as absolutely similar places as possible. I mean, this is a long experiment. It's kind of, you know, I'm not sure that I'd do it, but, you know, it is at least a testable theory. So if you had two identical rooms and you put identical things in them, and then you had one of them, let's say, for a year, you had people going in there every day and meditating and praying and whatever else it might be, and the other one not, then you get naive people who've never been in either of the rooms to go in. And in one room, they should feel something and not in the other. So it is a testable theory, and therefore it's worth discussing and worth testing. But I do not see any reasons to believe in it. I think it's the sort of reasons I've described much better explain those thrills and that peace and that feeling of joy.
And you're not just importing, I mean, what Rupert has been saying throughout is that you and others are importing a sort of naturalistic, materialist assumptions about reality into these experiences. And he's just, you know, has a bit more of an open mind.
Yeah, that's my working assumption.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's a working assumption, but I'll tell you this. I've been very lucky, and here's a bit more gratitude, lucky in a way that didn't seem lucky at the time, that I absolutely believed in all sorts of paranormal phenomena, as I've said, early in my research life. And that's what I wanted to do to prove to the world. And I found I was wrong. And I had to change my mind. Change my mind big time. I was Sue the tarot reader. I was Sue the one wearing the hippie clothes and going on about telepathy and precognition and all those kinds of things. I was identified with that. And I had to change who I was as well as my academic beliefs. So the point of that is, I know I can do that, and if I had to do it again, I know it would be painful, but I would do it again. So when I say those are my assumptions, you can't do science, you can't be in the world without having some assumptions, but I think it's a question of kind of holding them lightly.
Okay.
These discussions we were having earlier about consciousness are like that. Well, I hold lightly the possibility that consciousness pervades the universe or is what it is or something. We have to have some assumptions, and mine are basically, let's go for a bottom-up. I'm thrilled by the idea of bottom-up explanations, and Rupert isn't. But, you know, I try to hold these things lightly and enjoy the science.
Let me come back to you, Rupert, because obviously Sue is concerned that it's very shaky scientific grounds on which you base your ideas of morphic resonance and so on. And it says she was involved in some of the early experiments, didn't appear to show anything of the sort. And we should do these sort of blind, you know, double blind tests and so on. And that's the way to find out. And she says she just doesn't think that's ever shown anything along the lines of what you're talking about.
Well, of course, we completely disagree. And whereas she thinks there's no evidence for things like telepathy, I think there's a lot. You know, I've done experiments on telephone telepathy, dogs and cats that know when their owners are coming home. I think there's tons of evidence. And most people accept this and, in fact, take it for granted. So I completely disagree with her about the status of the evidence. I think there's quite a good bit of evidence for morphic resonance as well. This is a scientific dispute about evidence. We have different interpretations of it, and we have different assumptions. I mean, she has an assumption that some of these memory effects depend on what she calls memes, an idea taken from Richard Dawkins, of things that propagate, ideas that leap from mind to mind.
They're sort of the cultural equivalent of genes in biology.
Yeah, I think memes work by morphic resonance, you see.
Okay.
So I don't think her theory is that different from mine, because no one's ever seen a meme or crystallized one or anything. It's not that kind of thing. And so I think what we've got here is her act of faith in bottom-up explanations and in materialism is an assumption, as she agrees. And it's a way of looking at the world, and it's an assumption you can make. I hold assumptions too, but mine is that consciousness is within and beyond nature. It's not, God is not separate from nature. God is in nature, and nature is in God. That our memories are not stored in our brains, and something of our consciousness can persist after death. These are assumptions. They're acts of faith. So I don't say that neither of us can claim that science proves our points of view. Sue could claim that she's in more of a majority position within science, which is dominated by materialist assumptions. I'm definitely in more of a minority position.
We're going to go to final thoughts now. So, Sue, just as we start to close out the discussion, how do you want to leave us as we conclude the programme?
There's a strong disagreement. We've just shown it. Yep, but it's evidence-based, and therefore time will tell. And I think time will tell that there isn't any telepathy and there isn't any morphic resonance. And life after death is a tricky one because we can't really tell about that. But the agreement that I do have is all of these practices, they're all ones that I have practiced, or and some of them do practice frequently. And that is, you know, good for you, Rupert, because to be able to show how they benefit everybody, regardless of their beliefs, that's important and badly needed in the world. So that much we absolutely agree on.
Well, it's good that we had a note of agreement at the end of the show, at least. And I think anyone reading will find a lot of interest in the ways in which you spell out the actual scientifically proven aspects of whether you believe they're coming from a divine source or not, that things like prayer, meditation, ritual, singing, chanting, music, pilgrimage and so on can have on people. And you spell out some of the ways in which it is sort of even being recognised by modern day atheists like Alain de Botton, his well-known book, Religion for Atheists, saying perhaps we too readily, you know, got rid of all the trappings of religion, even if we don't agree with the central message of it. But great to have you in on the programme today.
A pleasure to be here, and great to talk to Sue and to you.
Well, I was really glad to get you both in conversation. I thought you two would probably make the ideal sparring partners, and it turned out to be true. So thank you very much for being in on Unbelievable
Thanks.
With me today.
It'd be great to talk to you, Rupert.
Great to have you, Sue. Sue's book, of course, available now if you want to get hold of that. It's called Seeing Myself, The New Science of Out-of-Body Experiences, and Rupert's book, available now, Science and Spiritual Practices. We'll be back in a moment's time with some of your feedback to recent shows.
If you want to have a massive reason why human beings are special, here it is. God became one.
We can be part of God's plan to bring hope to a hopeless generation.
We're living in an exciting time to be a follower of Jesus. The golden age of Christianity, ladies and gentlemen.
We live in a universe that has a story that is ultimately about love.
There's a God-shaped hole in the heart of every person. It can only be filled by God, made known through Jesus Christ.
Hear the world's leading Christian thinkers make the case for Christ at Unbelievable, the Conference 2017. Now available not only on DVD, but also as a digital download. Order online at premier.org.uk/shop.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the final part of today's edition of Unbelievable, and an unusual amount of time in this third segment to get through some of your feedback in recent editions of the show. So it's lovely to be able to spend some time delving into the various thoughts and comments and feedback you've given to some of the programmes that have been on recently. Just a reminder before we get into some of that, that if you want to get in touch about anything you heard on today's show, you can email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I read every email I receive. I can't respond to them all, of course, and only a certain selection of them actually make it onto the airwaves, because there are too many really to read them all out, I'm afraid. But that's a good way to do it. That's the most likely way you're going to actually get your thoughts read out in the feedback section of the programme, is by emailing me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Though I do try and keep abreast of all the comments that come in other forms, via Twitter, via Facebook, underneath the show each week on the webpage as well. So if you want to do that, at UnbelievableJB to tweet me your comment, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page, where you can talk about the latest show and be updated by me on a regular basis about exciting things and little articles and things that I want to put in your direction, and all of those links and more available along with the podcast and everything else at the show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. As I say, as a podcast special in the coming week, I'm going to release the first chapter of the audiobook on the Unbelievable podcast, so that might whet your appetite for getting hold of the audiobook itself, or indeed the print version of the book. And it's been great to have various people commenting on it and rating it on Amazon. Here's one from Perry Marshall, who I actually got to see in London just recently, actually. So hi, Perry, if you're listening. But where it was, he's very kindly left this review as a reader. You could think of this book as a grand tour of apologetics from the one guy who has interviewed more atheists and apologists than just about anybody. But it's more than that. It's also a demilitarized zone, much like the strip of land between North and South Korea, where no shooting is allowed and where peaceful talks can take place. We need this very badly today, as the issue of polarization of social media and the inability for people to talk and listen to each other has reached an acute stage. I gave a talk at Arizona State University in August 2017 and said there are four rules of the demilitarized zone. No one gets to hide behind screen names. No weapons.
assume your opponent has positive intent, and 4, get to the truth, not the sale. Nobody practices this better than Justin. In the book, he tells the story of how at first many listeners to Premier Christian Radio complained that, gee, don't atheists get enough airtime already? But in order to create that demilitarized zone, Justin had to grant them space. Unbelievable is now the biggest demilitarized zone between atheists and Christians in the world. Justin maintains his posture in this book. Here you'll find a series of excellent arguments for Christianity, but Justin always retains his get to the truth, not the sale stance, where he presents evidence but still leaves it to the reader to decide. This indicates his faith in the power of truth to assert itself in the end, and reflects a certain degree of security and calmness, where in many other places the efforts to shut down conversation convey insecurity and doubt. Thank you very much, Perry, for that lovely recommendation of the book. Another one here from Dave, a shorter one, says, as an agnostic, I've really enjoyed Justin's podcast series, Unbelievable. Was really keen to see the book release. Well written and fairly easygoing. I enjoyed reading this and did give me a bit more food for thought. I'm still not quite converted yet, but will continue my quest and see where it takes me. For anyone with even a passing interest in Christianity, I'd certainly recommend this book as a good starting point. As in his podcast, Justin comes across as a nice bloke, someone you'd love to have a good long chat in the pub to. That's sort of the way I approach Unbelievable, Dave. And if you ever do get a chance to have a good long chat in the pub, I'd be up for that. If you want to read the book for yourself that they're referencing there, Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. Signed copies available now from the website at the Premier page. That's unbelievablebook.co.uk. Might provide a nice Christmas present for yourself or someone else you know who would like to hear about the story of this show and my case for faith. Here's one from Rhys, who says, greetings from the past. Just a quick email to say hello from early 2012. Since a couple of friends put me onto your podcast last year, I've been steadily working my way through the back catalogue. Going right back to 2007, I'm now up to 2012, but still a fair way to go before I catch up. Think it's a great format you have, providing multiple viewpoints on tricky topics and maintaining civil debate. You do a great job of presenting and moderating. You don't hide your own Christian worldview, and neither should you, given it's a Christian radio station, but manage to keep it in appropriate tension with your role as moderator, and even playing devil's advocate or expressing an atheist viewpoint when necessary. Another aspect I've noticed, given that I'm listening to the podcast way out of sync, is how so many topics, even though the episodes were from years ago, are relevant to specific situations in my life now. For example, there were episodes I listened to on homosexuality and same-sex marriage from 2011 and 2012, when this was a hot topic in the UK, but one that's a current topic of debate here in Australia at the moment. There was also the interview with David Robertson after his ICU admission and coming so close to death, and the effect that had on him, and thinking through why God had preserved his life and what this meant for his future life and ministry. The episode comes at a time when I'm facing similar questions. I've made a remarkable, though possibly temporary, recovery from cancer that was expected to result in my death within a few months, but I'm still alive some 4 years later. I'm now pondering the same questions David was a few years ago, and it was great to hear his perspective in my current context. It's no accident I'm still alive, and I know it's only by God's grace rather than something I've done, but now I'm trying to work through what God might plan for my life from here on in. Anyway, you're doing a great job, and it's been an intellectually as well as spiritually stimulating podcast to listen to, has strengthened my faith in many ways over that time. Don't know if you still read out emails on the show, and I'm sure you get a lot more in 2017 than you did back here in 2012, but if you choose to read this one, I look forward to hearing it sometime in the hopefully not too distant future. Thank you very much, Rhys, in Australia. And of course, that issue of gay marriage has, of course, been decided more or less, at least, but in the public vote that took place this week in Australia, the results of which took place this week in Australia, where I think about 61% of the population voted in favour of changing the law to allow for same-sex marriage. And I expect that will happen in law in due course. But of course, we're just one of many different countries where that's being rolled through. I'm sure we'll sort of do something on that topic before too long again. So we've had some interesting stuff on the show recently, and I want to get to some of the mailbag of correspondence we've had to things like last week's programme on miracles, Ken Fish and Francis Janusz debating Ken's ministry, where he claims he sees miracles on a regular basis. That provoked a lot of chat as well underneath that that episode on the web page. Lots of people questioning the veracity of the claims that are being made, obviously, and I even got involved myself in one or two of the discussions on Facebook going on about it. But lots of emails about that. We've also got those really interesting discussions we had between Sean Carroll and Luke Barnes of a few weeks ago. Science Mike was in debating science as well. Lots of science being going on actually on the program recently, so we'll get to all of that and more, if we can. So let's see what you had to say. Now, Dan, who's an atheist, I think, got in touch with me, very concerned, says, deeply concerned by a number of your recent show topics, which seem not so much to be aimed at sound intellectual discourse, but rather for sensationalism. And that's disappointing. It's far from the high quality of material I've come to expect from Unbelievable. Out-of-body and near-death experiences, young earth creationism, miracle healings. And now, did I hear correctly, you're going to have Rupert Sheldrake on the show? It's not unlike the plethora of ghost hunter type shows that have popped up on the now poorly named History and Science channels on cable TV. I'm honestly beginning to wonder when you're going to have a flat earth guest. I realise you're going to occasionally have topics which I find not worthwhile, like miracle healings or the Shroud of Turin, because they do appeal to some, if not most, of the believing audience. But OBEs and NDEs are really on the fringe of what's intellectually reasonable, and Rupert Sheldrake is just beyond the pale. His morphic resonance is not grounded in Christian philosophy, theology, so there's no philosophical connection to the topic of religious debates. It's nothing more than intellectually bankrupt pseudoscience. In an effort to put my money where my mouth is, I plan on politely boycotting next week's show, by which I mean I will not be downloading it. I will also be sharing my thoughts about the selection of Sheldrake for a guest with the Unbelievable Facebook group. I do want to thank you for your hard work and many years of great program which Unbelievable has provided. It's only because I enjoy the show so much and I sincerely think that it's the finest program of its kind, a much needed oasis of reasonable discourse, that I am writing to you now. Well, I suppose you're not listening to this, Dan, because you've boycotted this edition of the show, which featured Rupert Sheldrake. But, well, what can I say? Not everyone agrees with you. And there are many people, which is why Rupert Sheldrake has an audience, who want to hear these kinds of discussions. And we do feature quite a variety of different types of Christians, like Rupert, like the occasional young earth creationist and so on, because that does exist out there. And I like to make sure we provide a kind of a ground for the variety of views that exist. Totally accept that it's not up your street and you're not going to bother listening to the ones you don't think you're going to enjoy. But sometimes we discover little nuggets, things that we didn't think we would have reason to consider when we do that. So I hope that one way or another you do end up listening to this program. This is from a listener who simply says they're in Liverpool. And we're going on to miracle healings now. That was the topic of last week's debate between Ken Fish, who has a ministry around the world where he engages in miraculous healings. That's what he claims. And we heard from a couple of people who claim that they've had miraculous healings through his ministry. Francis Janusz was our atheist, skeptical guest interacting with Ken. And what I thought was a really fascinating program. Anyway, this listener in Liverpool says, I've been listening to the discussion on miracle healing. My experience was more of a deliverance than a healing from smoking addiction in 1984. The day I asked Jesus Christ into my life, I was at home. Some Christian people I knew and had invited in to pray with me to ask Jesus into my life had come and left. I looked at the pack of cigarettes I had and I said to God, "You're going to have to help me give up smoking, Lord." There were two cigarettes left in the pack and I thought, okay, I'll just smoke the last two and then that's it. I tried to smoke one and I couldn't. It was as if I'd never smoked at all in my life. It tasted awful and I threw them in the bin. I've never touched nor smoked from that day to this. You may think I could have done it on my own, through my own willpower. I assure you I could never have done that. I had tried so many times before to pack it in but always failed. In fact, I was like a bear with a sore head, awful withdrawal symptoms. But when God delivered me from this addiction, I had no withdrawal symptoms whatsoever. Praise God. I used to smoke 40 a day, more if I could get them. The last one at night before sleeping and first thing in the morning as soon as my eyes opened. I was 30 at the time, had just given birth to twins. I've now 5 grown-up children, all married, and 11 grandchildren, number 12 due in the spring, God willing. It's something I wanted to do. No one told me that as a Christian I ought to give up. There you go. What a fascinating story. Heidi says, listening right now, I was healed without prayer from 2 years of cystitis just by calling out, "Oh God." I fell asleep and 4 hours later woke up and a voice said, "Jesus has healed you." That was the 24th of October, 1979. And I have not had cystitis since. That healing convinced me to become a follower of Jesus. Interesting. And Graham. So coming more from the skeptical point of view here. Indeed, Graham is part of the Whitstable Skeptics group, I think. It says, just been listening to your discussion with Ken Fish and Francis Janusz. Haven't quite finished it yet. Felt compelled to send you some thoughts. The two miracles I've so far heard raised the following issues for me. The lady who grew her little finger back. If Mr. Fish is actually saying he saw it physically grow back, if so, this would indeed be miraculous. The sort of evidence Christians have been desperate for generations, but perplexingly, he obviously didn't think so at the time. It would have been relatively easy to find other witnesses to her missing finger. There might be reports from doctors. There would be a story about how she lost the finger in the first place, but none of this was attempted or even thought about at the time. There used to be a website entitled What Has God Got Against Amputees, but this occurrence, if evidence could be found, would have been groundbreaking. The other case of a lady who recovered from cancer in her bones. Wonderful for her that she's made such a recovery, but it must be said she did receive a huge amount of medical care. In terms of the data you were looking at, Francis was right. None of you are medically trained. Would it have been difficult to ask a cancer specialist to study the data and give his or her opinion? What about the consultant who was reported to have said medical science could not explain the results? Unfortunately, we only have the word of the lady that that was what they said. Why not ask the consultant who knew the case for their take on what happened? There are glaring differences as to how science investigate phenomena and the cavalier approaches of miracle believers. There are huge numbers of devout Christian doctors who would be able to give chapter and verse regarding these miracles, but never do. Thank you very much, Graham. Obviously, not convinced whatsoever. I must say, it takes just getting the amount of input we did for that programme took quite a bit of work and effort. So it's really resources, time and everything else that stops me from being able to go deeper and get all of those sorts of types of confirmation and people that it would be nice to have to talk about these sorts of things. But I do appreciate that that would be the soundest way, in a sense, of having a doctor who could give a considered opinion on the type of cancer and everything else. Richard Morgan, friend of the show, former atheist, became a Christian, has had some interesting discussions on the show with people like Francis, who's a friend of his. Just listen to my friend Francis Janisch in discussion with Ken Fish. I've just one comment or question for all concerned. Victoria Bixby was suffering from a condition that was very rare in adults. So Victoria was the testimony about healing of cancer in the bones. It was this neuroblastoma. Necessarily, the statistics will be sparse because it's very rare in adults. No cases of healing have been found in the annals of medical history for Victoria's condition. But now this one should appear somewhere, shouldn't it? Never again will anybody be able to say it's never been seen before. Never again will a senior attending oncologist be able to say it doesn't happen. Or will they? Will Victoria's case be written into the records? Will it be quoted to future patients? Will oncologists say to them, you need the Ken Fish treatment? If not, why not? All good questions, Richard. Questions I don't have the answer to, but I understand what you're saying. And I've no idea whether her case has gone on record as a unique and unusual incident in which the cancer, as it were, well, what was left of the benign cancer throughout her skeleton almost disappeared overnight. So Matthew Taylor got in touch via Facebook, said, still a listener to your show, met you at the Unbelievable conference last year. In my Christian days, I was involved in prayer for healing in my church. I heard many anecdotal stories of dramatic healings in my time, yet none ever happened in front of us. All the stories we used for encouragement were secondhand, and never was there a first-hand account. That's exactly how legends begin. Secondhand accounts get repeated and adjusted. Worse still, amazing accounts are accepted as true without question. I see this a lot in my Christian friends. Stories often repeated uncritically because it paints God in a good light. The due diligence one would expect isn't carried out. The story you featured of the healed finger jumps out at me. Did one have before and after photos? I also have a problem with the self-reported stories you featured. You have Christians retelling stories of their own healing. Of course, they will tell it in a way that emphasizes what it is that they believe happened. These are lay people reporting their version of what medical people said. If these are people that believe healing happens and want healing to happen, then they're primed to record it according to their preference. Thank you very much. Appreciate you getting in touch, Matthew. What we're trying to do, of course, with those stories that we heard from Victoria and Carol in the course of that program was to also have some medical evidence that confirmed at least that aspect of their story. In the case of Victoria, we did have that in the form of the reports that showed the way that the neuroblastoma or the benign form of the cancer in her bones seemed to suddenly go from over 90% to less than 10%. Admittedly, we haven't at this point had been able to ascertain the scans and so on that Carol said showed that her womb was completely transformed after having been diagnosed with lots of cysts and adenomyosis, I think it was called, and so on. But still open to receiving that as and when the hospital are able to release it to her. But thank you very much. Let me go just one more. Joel from Lethbridge in Canada, one of our Canadian listeners, says the healing show is interesting. I want to highlight one point brought out by the healer. He explains a word of knowledge as a word given by the Spirit. Most charismatics would define this as a rhema word, a fresh spoken word. Also, most charismatics get this view from a wrong differentiation between rhema and logos, the two Greek terms translated word. However, the charismatics define a word of knowledge as a fresh rhema word, but the actual Greek term is logos of knowledge. The definition does not even fit into their biblical definition. This is one of the most problematic parts of the charismatic movement. I believe they use scriptures out of context to define and practice whatever they like. Okay, perhaps that's enough for the moment, as there were lots of other emails sort of asking, questioning the records and so on. In fact, I got in touch someone on the Facebook group of Unbelievable, where a lot of the debates go on between Christians and non-Christians, was questioning, having found something online that seemed to suggest that adult neuroblastoma cancer sufferers do have a certain degree of living, life expectancy, and said this disproves immediately Ken's case of Victoria's. Well, that actually wasn't what was being claimed. It was that the there are no known cases where the cancer in the bones regressed in the way that it suddenly did for Victoria, I think was what they were talking about there. Not that neuroblastoma people with cancer never survive or anything like that. So that might be worth bearing in mind. Time is running away, as it often does. And I've got loads of these emails about that Sean Carroll versus Luke Barnes debate, where we had top cosmologist Sean Carroll from an atheist perspective, Luke Barnes, astrophysicist, who's going to join me, by the way, on the profile straight after today's programme for an extended conversation that we recorded while he was with us here in studio. But he had a great conversation as a Christian with Sean Carroll, asking things like, you know, is there evidence that the universe had a beginning to its existence? Does the fine-tuning of the universe provide evidence for God or naturalism? Here's Andrew Loke. He's Andrew T. Loke. He's a research assistant professor, actually, at the University of Hong Kong, and has a number of academic books to his name: God and Ultimate Origins, The Origin of Divine Christology, and A Cryptic Model of the Incarnation. And says, I appreciate Sean for recognizing the importance of philosophical reasoning. However, Sean made many problematic philosophical statements. To give a number of examples, in response to the question, if something such as the universe could begin to exist uncaused, why do other things such as bicycles not begin to exist uncaused? Sean replied that bicycles can't begin to exist within our universe because of laws of physics. Such an event would have violated the law of conservation of energy. However, as explained in detail in my book, God and Ultimate Origins, if something, such as the universe itself, as Sean claims, begins to exist without any antecedent condition whatsoever, then there would not be any antecedent condition which would make it the case that only universe, rather than other kinds of things, begins to exist. Moreover, the properties of universe and the properties of other kinds of things which differentiate between them would be had by them only when they had already begun to exist. What this implies is that if something begins to exist without any antecedent condition whatsoever, the beginning of existence of other kinds of things would also not require antecedent conditions. The beginning of something is susceptible to being preventable by a law of physics if its beginning requires antecedent conditions that the law can act on. However, as explained previously, if something begins to exist without any antecedent condition whatsoever, the beginning of existence of other kinds of things would also not require antecedent conditions, and thus the beginning of existence of bicycles would not have been preventable by natural laws. Thank you very much, Andrew. You raised some other points in there as well, but perhaps we'll move on to another email. Tim Boyle in Nagano, Japan, says, what a mind-boggling discussion. I'd agree with you there, Tim. It certainly was. After listening to Sean Carroll's perspective, I came to the conclusion he's not at all a dogmatic atheist, but seems humble enough to be open to there being a divine being behind it all, something that to my mind would put him in the agnostic category more than an atheistic one. I was, however, perplexed by some of the reasons he listed for his tentative conclusion that God as an ultimate explanation is much less likely in his mind than the no-God explanation of naturalism. I was surprised by his claim that we really have no basis for saying with any certainty what the outcomes would be in hypothetical universes with some particular fundamental constant being ever so slightly different from the value it actually is. Of course, we can only use such calculations through computer models and simulations as to whether such slightly different universes would have allowed life. But isn't that sufficient to reach the conclusion that our universe really is incredibly fine-tuned for life? Likewise, his claim that the kind of universe that we would expect given theism would be one that is so much smaller than what it really is in conflict with what I've heard from other cosmologists, namely that it takes a universe this big and this old for a planet like Earth to come into being, given the laws and constants of physics that we observe. Hugh Ross, for instance, says that mass density of the universe is so fine-tuned that even a slight amount greater or lesser than it was at the beginning would have resulted in a universe in which life could not possibly exist. That means it couldn't be any smaller than it is if it's going to operate according to the natural laws that we observe the universe to have. And this is a crucial point I think needs to be addressed. If we're to propose a creator God as the explanation for our existence here on planet Earth, would that really imply a much smaller universe? I don't think so. If God created the universe to operate according to the physical laws we actually observe, then it would have to be as vast as it is. Or is this conclusion wrong? I'd like to hear how Sean Carroll would address the point. Perhaps you should invite him back. Aristotle's Jedi says, really enjoyed the talk between Luke and Sean. Perhaps ironically, for reasons other than fine-tuning, it's a blessing to have two eminent and capable scientists engage in philosophical arguments. Can there ever be a brute fact? Is the Humean account of laws correct? Does naturalism or theism even make predictions? I want to point out an argument by Ed Fazer, where one cannot accept the Humean account of the laws of nature, as Sean does, and help yourself to just one brute fact, the terminus of explanation, as it were. For if we accept that one level of laws is explained by a more fundamental level, we will have what the scholastics called an essential series. To cut a long story short, and to use an analogy by Fazer, what Sean would essentially be saying is that the position of a book is explained by the shelf it rests on. In turn, the shelf is explained by the two brackets it rests on. But then there's no reason or explanation for why the brackets are there. Have you really explained the position of the book? Sean's position doesn't seem to allow for one brute fact at the end of the road. The implication seems to be that either everything has an explanation or nothing does. Thank you very much. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, Ed Fazer will be with us on a future edition, in a couple of weeks' time, in fact, here on Unbelievable, debating with atheist Cambridge philosopher Arif Ahmed. So set your phasers to stun. Whether Fazer will stun Arif Ahmed will remains to be seen in a couple of weeks' time on the show. So, but if you're into that kind of stuff, Aristotle's Jedi, you will definitely want to listen to that program, I'm sure. Okay, have we time for one more? Randy Ruggles from Huntsville, Ontario, says, it's been a while since I've written. I was compelled to write in after listening to Sean Carroll and Luke Barnes. I find Sean Carroll makes one of the same mistakes that a lot of atheists I interact with online make. That's the mistake of inventing an imaginary God and then proceeding to refute it. As an example, Sean says that God can do whatever he likes, so why did he make a universe so big? Sean believes his God would have created a much smaller universe, but where does Sean get this prediction? Certainly not from Scripture. In the Bible, we're told that the heavens declare God's handiwork. God knows that we would discover the inconceivable vastness of the universe, and that serves as evidence of his power and majesty. If God had merely created a universe as big as our solar system or galaxy, atheists might justifiably claim some God. Couldn't an all-powerful being do better than that? Further, Scripture indicates that human beings are special to God. So if we let the Bible be our guide, we would predict an incomprehensibly vast universe, but with complex life on only one planet, Earth. And guess what? That's exactly what we find. If life was ubiquitous in the universe, atheists might be able to say, see, we're not so special. When we use the Bible as a hypothesis to be tested, rather than inventing our own God, we find that the Bible turns out to be right every single time. Thank you very much, Randy, and thanks to all the others who have been in touch on the show. Chris Bastian, maybe for a final email on this subject. I agree that the universe shows the finely tuned principles of physics necessary to support life. I also agree that donkeys have neither intelligence nor vocal cords and so cannot speak, Numbers 22. But apologists will argue that if God is omnipotent, he can make a donkey speak. If so, he can also make life appear under any set of physical rules. Therefore, the odds that created life would require exactly the same rules that natural science would require appears to make God the far less likely choice. Well, sort of what we were debating, whether those natural laws that we do discover can be explained by naturalism, I suppose. That was the contention of the fine-tuning argument that they can't. But thank you very much. Great to have all of that stuff in, all of that feedback in, and a chance to go dive into it in a bit more depth at this part of today's programme. But we are at the end of this week's edition of Unbelievable. Hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. Don't forget to check out the website and indeed the Unbelievable book website if you want to get hold of that as well and find out why I'm still a Christian after hosting lots of atheist debates. Unbelievablebook.co.uk. This week's show and your comments welcome on it at premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. Still to come this afternoon, the profile. We're going to be hearing that extended conversation I had with Luke Barnes, the Australian astrophysicist we've just been talking about. But let me tell you, before we get to that, what's coming up on the show next week.
You're unbelievable.
Here on Unbelievable, you'll be able to hear my conversation with two ex-Mormons, Lynn Wilder and Corey Miller. They've contributed to the book Leaving Mormonism, Why Four Scholars Changed Their Mind, and they're going to be in discussion with British Mormon James Holt. So look out for that on your podcast, on your radio set next week. Until then, have a great week. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcasting software, and find out more about our other Premier podcasts at premier.org.uk/podcasts.